This is Kate Swanell for the NJA. Today our special guest is Professor Helena Teed, who is Professor of Women's Health at Monash University, as well as being Director of Monash Centre for Health Research and Implementation. Thank you for your time and welcome.
Thank you very much.
You've just been on the receiving end of a very tasty grant from the NHMRC for research into polycystic ovary syndrome. Can you tell us a little bit about that research, why it's important, and what you hope will come out of it clinically?
So, really great opportunity. So, thanks for the opportunity to talk about what is actually a very important condition. So, polycystic ovary syndrome is a condition that affects up to 1 in 5 Australian women, much more common in Indigenous young women. Mm-hmm. And we know from Australian research, and Australians have been at the forefront of this area and leading this area now for quite some time, but we know that many of those women are undiagnosed. And there are many reasons for that. It's a complex condition. And it's a complex condition because it affects many different parts of a woman's body and it varies across the lifespan. So at a young age, during adolescence, it makes the menstrual cycles irregular and causes increased facial and body hair and acne. It also appears to make young women more predisposed to weight gain. All of those things are not particularly great for self-esteem, as you can imagine, and in a young woman it often has psychological implications. There's more anxiety and depression and more impact on quality of life. Now, often we know in Australia and many countries, what then happens is those young women are put on the oral contraceptive pill to regulate their cycles. They're not necessarily diagnosed, and they go through their early 20s up until their late 20s unaware that they have the condition until they come off the pill wanting then to conceive. Yeah. And we've lost opportunities, really, to manage many of the problems, but also to look at optimising fertility and other complications. So once we get into the early 20s, the relevant reproductive features we've just described remain, but there's an increasing metabolic risk. So we know these young women are at much higher risk of getting prediabetes and diabetes at a young age and progressing. They have abnormal lipid profiles and cardiovascular risk factors, which are much higher. And again, they often continue to put on weight. And then as they get older, those metabolic features predominate even more. So it varies across the lifespan. And once women get to menopause, many of the reproductive features are not as dominant, but the metabolic features become far more so. So one of the problems with the condition is, first of all, the ovaries are not polycystic.
Okay.
So the name is incorrect. It's historically incorrect. There are no cysts on the ovaries, and this is a real source of confusion for women and health professionals alike.
Right.
And we've done that research in Australia amongst women and GPs and specialists, and people think they're cysts, and they're not. They're simply follicles or eggs that become dormant because they don't like the hormonal environment. So they sit there, and they're a secondary feature of the condition, and then that causes infertility and irregular cycles. However, the real problem in PCOS is the hormonal underlying problem. So we know these young women have a genetic problem, and often that risk comes from their parents and can be manifested as polycystic ovary syndrome in their parents or type 2 diabetes. And then they bring those genes with them, and then the more sedentary lifestyle and increased weight gain we're now seeing in our community makes that worse. So the hormones that underpin it are both insulin resistance and also elevated androgens, and it's the combination of both that cause the problem. They can drive increased weight gain, but increased weight gain also makes them worse, so it's a bit of a vicious cycle. Those two hormonal factors then underlie the cosmetic or hirsutism and acne features we see, the ovarian features with irregular cycles and infertility, and longer-term increased risk of uterine cancer because they're not ovulating, and then also drive the cardiovascular risk factors. All of those together drive the psychological and impact on quality of life factors. So it's complex.
Yeah.
So if you invariably go and see a dermatologist as a young woman because you're worried about one particular thing, you may just have that managed and not have anything addressed from another point of view. If you see a GP when you're young with irregular cycles, you may just get the pill for your irregular cycles. And if you see an endocrinologist, you may get something completely different. And again, we've done that research in Australia to show that depending on where you go, you get different tests and different diagnoses. So it's complex, and essentially these young women fall through the gaps of our increasingly specialised health system. And so many years ago, as a younger clinician, I would see these young women, often with their mothers, and they would come in and say, we've been told we have this, and we've been told we'll never have children. And that was, I think, one of the main things that pulled at my heartstrings, if you like, as a clinician, and thought, no, there's a real problem here. These girls are not being diagnosed, they're not being well supported and managed. It's a real gap. and we ought to do something about it. And so I, at that time, was an academic in women's health, mainly in menopause and estrogens, and was also an active clinician, endocrinologist. So I started on a bit of a increased focus in this condition, and we undertook quite a bit of research. And we published that research, we presented it to academic audiences, and we got grants, and it was wonderful, and it wasn't changing anything. And so I reflected about the fact that I was becoming disillusioned with my academic career because I was ticking all the metrics boxes, but I wasn't changing practice. So we thought we really had to do things differently, otherwise I was disillusioned both clinically and academically. We thought, as a revelation, we really need to start with the patient stories. So we got the patient support group together and we held a national workshop. Mm-hmm. And that was the defining moment, because we started off with the voices of the women with the condition. We got them to actively participate in prioritising the areas. We had probably 50 people nationally from all different disciplines, all different academic backgrounds. We had media people, we had government, we had all the stakeholders we could think of. And all of the political agendas disappeared because it became about the difficulties these women were experiencing with their condition. And I remember the then president, who was a very well-known woman because she was in journalism, made the statement that having polycystic ovary syndrome made you feel like you were going to get fat, infertile, depressed, and hirsute.
Yeah.
And who would want to admit to or engage in a discourse around something like that? And that was very profound. So we took those 2 days of workshop, and we came out with priorities. And we then worked quite closely with government. Mm-hmm. And I had the fortune at one stage, with my not-for-profit hat on, of working very closely. And I met Nicola Roxon on several occasions. And actually, she became a very good mentor. And, you know, I said, what's it going to take to be able to progress this forward? And she said, if you're working with government, you only bring 3 priorities. Any more than that, you haven't got a hope. And you need to bring everybody to the table with you so there are no dissenters.
Right.
So we had already done a lot of that work.
Yeah.
And we were very much community-led. We then had the fortune of having our support group, POSSA, turn up at every community cabinet around the country and say, Minister, what are you doing about PCOS? Until finally I had the Parliament and then the community parliament on the background on APC one night. It was about 11 o'clock and that question was asked, and the health minister then said, we're going to work with POSSA and the group that I was with, and we're going to work to promote awareness of this condition. And that was the first time we found out we were going to be funded.
What date are we talking about?
So we're talking about 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. So we got quite a generous government grant, although they've since said it was very good value for money. And the biggest priority for the consumers was to develop evidence-based guidelines and to disseminate and implement them. So we developed the first evidence-based guidelines in the world on polycystic ovary syndrome. Went through all the standard procedures with the NHMRC, and they were endorsed by, or improved by the NHMRC, beg your pardon. And so that was a very important process. But then off that, we launched our dissemination implementation plan. And that was the most satisfying, because we have changed practice. So we know from our research that there's been an increase in diagnosis. Mm-hmm. We know that there's an increase in the appropriate screening and models of care that occur in these women. We know that there's been improvements around the access to care that they can have, and we've had new models of care that have been developed. So that, finally, I'm no longer disillusioned with either academia or clinical practice, but clearly the element of leadership and collaboration and community engagement is absolutely fundamental. We developed resources where the primary care docs developed their own resource. It was a 5-page small flip chart from our 1,100 pages, and it's used. The a group of multicultural women developed their multicultural resource. Indigenous group developed the Indigenous resource, which was yarning about PCOS.
Yep.
So there was a whole range of resources. The website is really very impressive. And we recently had to report back to the NHMRC about the impact of our work. And we had a number of ways to talk about that. 26,000 people have downloaded the resources, not just read them online. So we know that that's the people coming to and pulling the information.
Patients or doctors?
Mainly consumers and patients and their families, but there's a health professional section, and the GP resource has been very well downloaded. But perhaps even more excitingly now, we were invited to present at the National Institute of Health in late 2012 on a focus priority workshop on PCOS, because it's now been recognised in the US as a big problem. So we went to that workshop. We were some of the only people internationally who presented, and the NIH basically came out and said the rest of the world should follow the Australian model. They commended the model because it was patient and consumer-led, and said there were lots of lessons, and largely followed the recommendations from the guideline. The WHO then contacted us and asked, rather than reinventing the wheel, given the rigorous process we went through, could they leverage off the work we've done? And they have contracted us, and we've been working with them. Fantastic. So they'll now become international recommendations, which is great. So it's very exciting. And one of the key things I think about the message is it's all about empowering the patient. It's all about prevention. It's all about assisting them to focus on prevention of weight gain rather than waiting until it's very difficult for them, and about their fertility options and optimising that. So it's a patient-led model of care, and it's very much about educating health professionals to work together but empowering the patients to own that problem which they're going to have lifelong, and very strongly focused on primary care. So the CRE, which is the Centre for Research Excellence, is $2.5 million. It's in part recognition of the work we've done to date, but what it really is it gives us the opportunity to address the research questions, because we've done the education dissemination, to start to address the research questions, to update the guidelines and extend them to the next areas that women wanted addressed, because we couldn't do everything. And so that work will also happen, and a big dissemination campaign, which will not just be Australian, but will be international. Translation and also training and capacity building for health professionals and for the consumer support groups. To increase that work and to engage internationally. Now a woman with PCOS, or at least in the next 5 years, will be able to say, I understand what causes the condition, I understand what the natural history is, I understand how I can ameliorate that, I understand how I could treat it if I can't prevent it. And it will be much, much easier to have better insight, plus we'll also have some insight into new treatments, which we're investigating now.
Tell us a little bit about your career path.
Okay, so I went into medicine. So I was doing my VCE, I was going to be a nurse, and then I went to the hospital open day, and literally I was raised in a very liberal family. My father had always given me, you know, equal opportunity to do anything I wanted, but I just had in my mind I was going to be a nurse. And I went to the hospital open day, and there were all these young female medical trainees, and I thought, maybe that would be something I'd want to do. And a friend of my parents' family's actually was a charge nurse in coronary care, and she gave me some really good advice and said, look, this is the way I see nursing, and this is the way I see medicine. And she talked about both of them with equal respect. And she said, so it's really about what would appeal most. And she said, also, if you start with medicine and it's not quite right, you can come back to nursing. You can't go the other way. And so I took that advice on, and then I was successful in my VCE to be able to go into medicine. I chose to go to Monash University. So I trained there and then went on to Prince Henry's in the city, which then was demolished, and moved out with Prince Henry's when it came to Monash Health many, many, many years ago. I then went off into training around different places, did a brief fellowship in Canada, went and spent quite a bit of time with my to-become husband, where we travelled for a year and had some time off as well, and spent a lot of time in Africa and third world. Then came back and decided on endocrinology because it's the most diverse of the specialties, I believe. It is, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're doing osteoporosis and bone or thyroid or female reproductive health, which is where I mainly am now, male reproductive health, diabetes as a chronic disease, increasing the obesity and the hormonal impacts. It's incredibly diverse. And most of the time we can fix those problems. And if they're chronic, they're very much about partnering with the patients and their family to help them through that journey, which I particularly enjoy. So that was the diversity. And I suppose the academic interest. The academic background was very strong, and the mentors in Australia for me were critical. So Professor Henry Berger, who's an international doyen, was my original mentor. Professor Rob Norman, who I must say co-led with me a lot of the work we've done in PCOS. He's based in Adelaide and is, again, an international doyen in the field. So I worked with the fantastic mentors and went into female reproductive health, then did a PhD in clinical research, and then got to the point where I decided, I had both a clinical career here and my research, very integrated, but then got to my point of frustration, as I described, so I started going in a different direction. And now I spend quite a bit of my time doing leadership, networking, engagement. And that's what the centre is. So the centre that I've set up is the Monash Centre for Health Research and Implementation. And it's a joint partnership between the largest health service in the country, which is Monash Health, and the largest university, which is Monash University. And my opportunities through Monash Health were not just clinical, but were also in leadership. So I did a basically an exec MBA program for 18 months, and then I also did a Williamson Leadership Program Community, which is a Victorian community leadership program for a year, and they were absolutely fundamental in the approach that I took in working with government and with consumers and in that sort of stakeholder leadership space. Very importantly, I am married to a very successful, talented, busy clinician who is trained in both intensive care and respiratory medicine and did a PhD in sleep. And we have two children and we have equally parented them the whole way through. And we have parented them. I have help in the home to do the housework. Nobody cares who washes the dishes or irons the clothes, but the children care who brings them up. So we've largely done that, the two of us, all the way through. And yes, we have busy lives, but we still have control over it. So
you talked a little before we started recording about this issue, you know, the question of how do you do it? How do you be superwoman? Talk a little bit about that, and you mentioned you were interviewed when you turned 40 about that sort of thing, and how your views have changed since then.
So when I was reflecting before this interview, when I was 40, I was interviewed for the careers section, I think it was in The Age, as a young female academic, and I got my professorship before I was 40, and so that was a bit of an unusual milestone in the Faculty of Medicine. In fact, the first meeting I turned up, they all came to me for the papers because I thought I was the secretary, which I decided to take as a compliment. But having said that, I got the interview in that context. It was very flattering. And at that stage, I said, yes, you can do all these things. Just have some help at home. But yes, you can have an academic career and have a leadership role and have a clinical career. So I was full of enthusiasm about everything you could do. And then some 6 years, 7 years later, don't know why, but I was re-interviewed. It wasn't a particular event at that time. And I reflected differently then, and I hadn't compared the two until just recently. But I reflected that actually you can't have it all because it's just too difficult to be across everything. Mm-hmm. But you can have what you want as long as you can work out what that is and focus on it.
What would you say to a young medical graduate or junior doctor today about going into endocrinology or women's reproductive health specifically? Is there a glut or is there a shortage?
Oh, it's a shortage.
Yeah.
First of all, I'd say of anyone who is a young medical graduate that they are going to be incredibly privileged, because the reality is we are privileged. We often work a bit too hard to realise that, so we don't take our head out of the sand. But in this 12-month community leadership program I did, which is highly selective and it was a real privilege to do, I realised about two-thirds of the way through the year that they had chosen this group of people, particularly on their values, because it was about giving back to the community. But I realised that for a lot of the people who went to work, they went to work every day and the key outcome ultimately was improving the shareholders' bottom line or improving the company's profile. Whereas I could go to work almost every day and be quite satisfied that I had improved something for someone and that I had given back in some way. So it was a revelation. I know it's very simple, but it was actually a very powerful revelation that I actually had a real privilege to do that. And it's why, no matter what the temptations, I'll never give up my clinical practice. I think the other thing I'd say to people is get a mentor, get several mentors, and don't just get people in medicine.
Yeah.
Get people, they might be your best friend's mother or father or somebody you meet in a different forum. But I think mentors, not your boss, but your mentor, who will help guide you, are invaluable.
How do you formalise a mentoring relationship?
I think it's more organic, but it's very much based on relationships. I don't personally believe that forced mentorship arrangements work very well.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of mentoring with young women because when I came, even though I'm not that old, when I came to specialise, it was really surprising. I did not have a single female mentor who had a family life and an academic and clinical career, and yet there were many male mentors out there who had it. So I decided that was what I wanted to do and tried to find mentors in other fields. But I think that's one of the reasons why I've been a mentor to many other young women. To answer your question about why mentoring, to me, it's just someone giving you a different perspective. And so I have had multiple mentors. I did it with someone senior in government. I did it with senior academics. But when you ask someone to mentor you, you say, I respect you, that I think you've got credibility, that I would like you to help shape, you know, me and who I am. It's a real compliment. Yeah. And very rarely, as long as you don't abuse that, are people going to say no. As doctors, we often think we should be able to cope with everything that we cope with. And I do think that being a doctor in this day and age is a bit harder than it used to be. I think the temptation as a clinician is to know everything about very little. It's easy. But I suspect we'll end up with a bit more of a rebalance as we have a shift in understanding. Mm. And so my new primary passion, which I've really been on that journey over the last few years with PCOS and now more broadly, is about improving the patient experience. And so I worked on that heavily in PCOS, but it's now become a much broader agenda. So my role in Monash Health is not just as a head of unit, but I have a healthcare improvement role. And that healthcare improvement role is very firmly focused on patient experience. But the light at the end of the tunnel, I think, is as we get over this idea that the responsibility sits only with the healthcare provider, mm-hmm. and actually learn that the responsibility sits jointly with the patient, the family, yep. and the healthcare provider, and that we walk together with, that we hold the expertise around the medical content, but the patient and their family hold the expertise around their life, their preference, their culture, their belief, and we walk together. So that working together with the patient and patient-centered care is not the patient necessarily having medical expertise, although they should be very well informed, but us not also assuming we have the expertise to make very important decisions mm. on behalf of the patient and family. And I think when we understand that we're moving from the sage on the stage to the guide by the side, and our roles are clear, and the legal responsibilities actually catch up with that phenomenon, mm. I think it's a really exciting phase to go into medicine.
Thank you so much for your time today.
It's all right. My pleasure.